Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh, and I'm joined as always by Frank Cagliano. But this is a very special episode because we are joined by a whole room full of people. Room full of people, clap, make yourself known.
We have a live studio audience.
Exactly. So all this week, Frank has been conducting an institute with Gilder Lehrman on Thomas Jefferson. Frank, do you want to tell the listeners at home something about the Gilder Lehrman Institute and what you've been doing the past few days?
Sure. The Gilder Lehrman Institute for American History is a nonprofit based in New York that promotes the study of American history. It does so particularly, through a variety of means, but most especially through a series of seminars that are held every summer across the country and indeed around the world, because several of them are international. There are about 40 of them in a given year for school teachers from around the country who come and spend a week together with an academic and with a master teacher. I'm looking at Carl, who's the master teacher from Gilder Lehrman on this week. And we've spent this week here in Edinburgh talking about Jefferson and the Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment is an obvious theme here for us in Edinburgh. And the format is very intensive. We spend a lot of time together each day, but there's a heavy emphasis on academic content, reading primary sources, and crucially, working with Carl and the other master teachers. The teachers participating in the seminar develop materials they can use in the classroom.
Right, so this session is gonna be sort of a Q&A session with the audience. So do we have a question from the audience for Frank?
Okay, so. Wait, Deirdre, please.
Sorry. So Frank, this is a question I asked you yesterday, but my question is about the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions and Jefferson's intent with the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, because at that point in the 1790s, it was fairly clear that had those actually come to, well, they got approved, but actually been acted upon, the nation would have unraveled, and it would have been ungovernable if every state could have made their own choices. So clearly he understood that. So my question is, what was his real intent? Was he just trying to call their bluff, or was it a power? That's where I'm going with that. So.
Okay, thank you, Deirdre. So the question is, what was Jefferson's intent with the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions? A little bit of background, because we didn't really talk much about that this week. The Virginia and Kentucky resolutions were resolutions adopted by the assemblies, the legislatures of Virginia and Kentucky. Sometimes things are exactly what they're called, in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts. And so in response to the Federalist-sponsored Alien and Sedition Acts, the legislatures of Virginia and Kentucky adopted resolutions condemning those acts. The resolutions, there are actually two sets of resolutions, one for each state, and they're slightly different. James Madison was the primary author of the Virginia resolutions, and Jefferson was the author of the Kentucky resolutions. The Kentucky resolutions went further than the Virginia resolutions, and they actually called for, in the Kentucky resolutions, the legislature of Kentucky resolved that states could basically nullify federal legislation that they deemed unconstitutional. So this was meant to be a remedy for the, seeking a remedy for the Alien and Sedition Acts. So remember, judicial review hadn't yet been established yet by the Supreme Court. And so it's a moment of constitutional experimentation. It's also a moment, you're right, Deirdre, in terms of the question, the premise of your question, that had this principle been established, theoretically, the government, the United States would have been ungovernable from that point onwards, because individual states would be determining what's constitutional and what isn't constitutional. Interestingly, although Virginia and Kentucky adopted these resolutions, they circulated them to the other states and no other states endorsed them. So they were kind of ignored by other states which recognized that this principle would make the country ungovernable. As to your question, what was he thinking? As you know, we spent a lot of this week saying, what was he thinking about this, that, or the other thing? I'm not sure he was thinking necessarily clearly about this. Jefferson was so outraged by the Alien and Sedition Acts and what he saw as the federal government overstepping its bounds and traducing civil liberties, that he felt an extreme reaction or an extreme response was necessary. I'm not sure he really necessarily thought through the implications of this. As I said, the Supreme Court's role had yet to be fully defined in 1798 and 99 when this is going on. And as a consequence of that, judicial review wasn't established. The kind of mechanisms we're used to for the court interpreting what's constitutional and what isn't hadn't yet been established. That precedent hadn't been established. And so, to some extent, he was responding to what he saw as a flaw in the Constitution. But if he'd truly thought through the implications of it, I'm not sure he would have done. And this is the reason Jefferson is often identified in the run-up to the Civil War, and I'm looking at David here, as one of the fathers of secession. Because this is there are echoes of the nullification crisis in the 1830s. This is an assertion of a kind of almost extreme states' rights if it had gone anywhere. It didn't go anywhere, and as we know, as we talked about yesterday, when he becomes president, he doesn't think about these things anymore, they're quietly forgotten. But it's an excellent question. Patience.
Speaking of the Supreme Court, we hadn't really had a chance to talk about Jefferson's reaction to John Marshall's appointment, and I wanted to know if you wanted to kind of further me his reaction to what Adams, he feels like Adams did to him, the worst thing he had done to was nominate John Marshall. Do you have any comments to that?
Well, we talked a little bit about this, remember, in terms of his response to his concern during his retirement with getting the Republican interpretation of history down, because he's averse to Marshall's interpretation of history and Marshall's biography of Washington, but he's more concerned with Marshall as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the direction Marshall took the court. And Jefferson is also concerned with Adams's packing of the judiciary, or his alleged packing of the judiciary. So the Federalists controlled the judiciary certainly for the time that Jefferson was president, and for a long time thereafter, and Jefferson saw this as a great threat and a great danger, and it was one of the reasons his relationship with John Adams soured in the way it did, and it took, a long time for them to patch things up. So he's very concerned about judicial overreach, to be sure.
But what's his response to Marbury versus Madison? I mean, do we have any evidence on? Did he write anything about? I mean, what's
I'm trying to think of whether he had a direct response to Marbury. He thinks it's judicial. Well, he's worried about it because he's worried about judicial overreach. But again, apropos of Deirdre's question, well, if you're not going to have states nullifying legislation or deeming what's constitutional and what isn't, which is basically a recipe for chaos in a confederation, then somebody has to adjudicate these things. So I don't think he objects to the principle so much as his concern that Federalists won't be fair in implementing it.
Although in the short term, didn't he actually kind of win that case? Because the Madison there is his Secretary of State, so in some ways he wins the short term court
that's
case.
Right. That's a very good point, yes, yeah. But it's the principle that's the same,
to be
sure.
Yeah.
What I really enjoyed this week was trying to delve into the complex nature of Jefferson. I think that's really, really great, and I think this is something that I'd love to bring to my classroom. And this is a question for you, Frank, and also Piers, because you guys are all great history teachers, but how should we complicate Jefferson in our classrooms? Because, obviously, we've had this huge week to be academics and really think and delve about think deep about this question, and then we can, focus on various parts of his philosophies, him wanting men to be equal, but also his stance on slavery, also his relationship or situation rather with Sally Hemings, but also this stuff that we talked today about his the fact that he was in debt, that all this kind of interesting stuff. So, what do you all? I'm gonna kind of ask my peers, but also you, Frank. How should we present, Thomas Jefferson to our students? A really good example of people being complex. I think that's great.
Right. Thank you, Azra. And I'm happy to throw this open to the body of the Kirk as well. I think Jefferson complicates himself for us in the classroom. he's done us a real favor that way, because we can't help but deal with these complicated issues once we start talking about them. It seems to me the obvious thing to do, and I know you all teach at different levels, so some of you are even teaching in elementary schools and on up, it all goes back to the Declaration. Right? I mean, or you can begin with the tombstone, right? The first thing on the tombstone is author of the American Declaration of Independence. why do we still talk about Jefferson? Why will we continue to talk about Jefferson? It goes back to that. There are the other achievements that are really important. There are the other failings that are significant when we think about that. But it goes back to the Declaration and that statement that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? Because that statement, it's a beautiful statement. It's incredibly, it's a very powerful statement. As a creedal statement, it's incredibly important and significant historically. But it calls to mind all the things we've discussed. Okay, so we talked about the origins of that and the Enlightenment and all that. And what does it stand for? And republicanism and people, men and women governing themselves. But there are the limits of it. Okay, all men. Okay, what does he mean by that? Where are the women? What does men mean in the context of 1776 and all that? So it seems to me, Osra, that's the gateway into it, because that's what he's most famous for, and rightly so, and that's what he's most historically significant. That's why that's the basis of his historical significance, and it calls together all these other threads. It seems to me that as you put it, the complexity, and we know the complexity. Whether it's we've used the word hypocrisy at different times this week. It's complicated stuff. It's morally problematic stuff. And I've been very impressed with both the quality of the discussion you all have had, but also the respect with which you've had it, because this is hard stuff to talk about sometimes, aspects of this. And I get that, so I applaud you all. But I kind of look to the rest of you to answer Osra's question as to how you would introduce this in the classroom. Good.
I wasn't going to respond to that, but I could. I think once we start learning about historical figures, they're all enormously complicated, but they've been reduced to a few pages in a textbook or whatnot. So I don't think Jefferson is unique in that regard. I mean, the stakes were, I think, higher with Jefferson, given him saying things like all men are created equal. So, I mean, I think that's the beauty of teaching history, is unraveling that complexity. My question for you is, first off, I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. Yeah, so thank you.
We don't have very many listeners, so
I'll listen on two computers just to double it up.
Awesome!
My question is, you're at a pub with Jefferson, hypothetically speaking. Like, what would you want to, ask him, I guess? Having, read so much of this dude's work, what would you want to pick his brain about as a historian?
Besides which wine to order.
No, I'd want to know if he's paying, and I'd be pretty sure he'd say he was, but then I don't have my wallet.
He's not paying.
Forgot it. I'd really want to talk about the clause in the Declaration that was excised on the slave trade. Because as I said to you all the other day, I think if that's included, the Declaration is a far more radical document. And I'd want to, and the assertion that Africans are a people, he conceives of them as a nation, not unlike Anglo-Americans, who have rights and liberties that have been violated. I'd really want to ask him about that and what he meant. Did he mean that? I think that if I get one question with him at the pub, that's the question I want to ask him about, I think. What about you, David? What would you ask him?
I guess it depends on which point in his life I'm interacting with him, because I think the Jefferson who writes the Declaration of Independence in 1776 is not the same Jefferson you see when he's president, nor is it the same Jefferson who's in retirement. So partially depends on which phase of his life. I guess it depends if we're in the pub, if it's like a time traveling Jefferson in 2019. I guess it depends on whether we're in an 18th or 19th century pub or in a 21st century one. What he thought about the United States today, and what has, is this what he envisioned 200 years ago? To what extent is he approving of the ways in which the American society and government have evolved, and what is he horrified by? What is he surprised by?
Well, surely he'd be surprised by
everything. All, to be sure, yes. But once he's gotten through the culture shock of time travel, as one does in the movies, and had a chance to sort of digest and think about, is this what all men are created equal meant? Is this the kind of structures of government? What does he think about the ways in which power is distributed both within government and within society more broadly? I'd be curious what he thought about those kinds of issues. I'd be curious what he thought about Hamilton, the musical, and how he's portrayed in it. You know, I think there's...
I think he does really well in the second act of Hamilton. He should be pleased with that. Yeah, you know, if any of us get played by David Diggs, we're doing all right.
I have a question for both of you, actually, and it's convenient, David, that you are a Civil War expert. Knowing Jefferson is so complex and a slave owner, but also, as we've talked about, anti-slavery with the air quotes, what would have been Jefferson's opinion on the Civil War? How would he have dealt with that?
Shall I go first?
Yeah, why don't you give it a try while
He's worried about Civil War, and he's worried about the possibility, indeed the likelihood of Civil War. If you read what he has to say during the Missouri crisis, you know, when he writes, you know, it's like a fire bell in the night and all that, he is worried about Civil War in the United States over the slavery issue. So in that sense, I think he would have said, I told you so. And he's worried that Americans are going to ruin their experiment with Republican government, or are going to allow it to founder on this question that he claimed was sort of peripheral to the point. Now, we know it wasn't peripheral, and we also know it wasn't peripheral to his life. So when he's saying that, I think he's actually deluding himself a little bit, but I don't think he would have been surprised by the Civil War. David rightly said a minute ago that his views change over his lifetime, and I think they do. So the argument I tried to make to you all earlier in the week was, I do believe he's sincerely anti-slavery, especially early in his life, during the Revolution in 1776 and a couple of years after, whilst being a slaveholder. But as he gets older, he reconciles himself to the fact that slavery and the slave question isn't going to be solved in his lifetime. And I think he becomes more parochial and more not just Southern but Virginian as he ages. So I think, I mean, David can speak to this better than me. I think both sides invoked his legacy. I mean, Lincoln loved to quote Jefferson. I think to some extent the Confederates might have a stronger case. What do you think, David?
You know, at the end, near the end of his life, when the Missouri Compromise happens, you know, what he talks about the potential for civil war, and he talks about the potential for, you know, the question of slavery's expansion being the cause of the Union's demise. And the ways that he writes about that suggests that his adherence to the idea of the Union and the kind of promise of Republican government and the fragility of democratic institutions in a world in which democratic institutions were the exception rather than the rule, and the United States was, both during Jefferson's lifetime and then again in 1861, democratic institutions were the exception, and the United States was the example, the trial balloon of, is this going to work, and can democratic institutions sustain themselves in times of crisis? And I think he was worried about what message it would send to the rest of the world if the United States were to fail, what that would say about the capacity of people to govern themselves. And, you know, when South Carolina secedes in December of 1860 because they didn't like the results of a presidential election, I think Jefferson would have been horrified by that because he would have seen that as a rejection of the ways in which democracies are supposed to work. You know, we can think about the election of 1800, you know, which of course was a very contentious election, but then we can think about Jefferson's inaugural message, you know, where he says, we're all
Federalists, we are all Republicans.
You know, in the sense in which he wanted to, even at the end of a contentious electoral battle, he wants to create a mode of healing. And the Civil War is the antithesis of that.
Yeah, although in terms of the inaugural address, I mean, I think he says that because he knows it's not true.
Well, to be sure.
Yeah, so he's asserting something that he wishes were true, but it's not.
Yes, but I think he's at least signaling that as a value that he possesses.
Right.
Hard to tell.
So you just mentioned that Jefferson wrote African people have rights and liberties. So I'm curious what you think Jefferson's thoughts might have been on the colonization of Liberia, where former American slaves and their descendants went to Liberia and presumably would have had to take land from Africans already living there. And then the second question.
Really good question.
In the notes on the state of Virginia, Jefferson tries to justify slavery by comparing black people and white people and Native Americans. So I'm curious, would he have had thoughts about differences between enslaved Africans in America and Africans still living in Africa?
Two excellent questions. Thank you, Shane. He supports colonization. He supports Liberia. I mean, the main settlement of Liberia takes place after his presidency, but he supports colonization as an idea. I don't think he said anything about the colonization, the colonization of Africa in the sense of taking lands from people who lived in Africa. You know, he's got a big map of Africa in the hall in Monticello as you come in. It's right there. You can see it to this day. But he doesn't know that much about Africa in truth. So I don't think his understanding of Africa extended to thinking about the rights of the indigenous peoples who would have been affected by this colonization of former enslaved Americans.
Although neither did many of the other people who were involved in the American Colonization Society.
That's right.
I mean, a lot of Jefferson's peers, I think, were part of the American Colonization Society, were members.
Yes.
People like Monroe and Marshall were active members of the American Colonization Society, and Jefferson never joined. So he's in and amongst people who are more active on that front than he is.
Right, but I don't think they necessarily know any more.
To be sure, they know nothing.
The kind of colonization of Africa as a violation of the rights of the people who live there.
Yeah.
As far as your second question about what he would have thought about the kind of status of, or the comparing enslaved Africans to persons who are actually in Africa. That's interesting, because we talked about this earlier. He does subscribe to this view of stadial theory of history, which derives from the Scottish Enlightenment, that civilizations go through stages. He may have said, well, you know, the people who were enslaved in America who are returning to Africa have achieved a different level of civilization. That would be ideologically consistent with his view of history, and that's certainly how he speaks of Native Americans. However, as we discussed earlier in this week, with regard to people of African descent, he did argue in the notes that they're kind of separate from that, and their inability to progress was such that if he were logically consistent, and again, I'm answering on behalf of Jefferson, these are not my views, of course. Mm-hmm. If he were intellectually consistent, logically consistent, he would have said, well, then being enslaved in America shouldn't have made any difference at all, because they were incapable of achieving beyond a certain level, and therefore when they return to Africa, they will be among people like that. This is where the Jefferson of the notes is very different from the Jefferson who wrote the Declaration of Independence, particularly that excised passage about the rights of Africans, which, in answer to, I think it was Daniel, that's the question I'd want to ask him about, because I think that's really important and interesting.
I have a question about Jefferson and women. We touched upon the fact that he corresponded with Abigail, but did he have any serious political or philosophical discussion with any other woman at any point in time?
Yes. There's a woman named Madame de Staël who's in France who he writes to. He corresponds with her about Latin American independence. He writes to several female correspondents who he writes to about politics, including his daughter, Patsy. But in general, he does not believe that women are political beings in the same way that men are. So I think if I kind of gave it some thought, I could come up with a list, but the fact that we can name them kind of proves the point, whereas trying to name the men he corresponded with about politics would be impossible because there are so many. I mean, I'd basically be reading the index of the papers of Thomas Jefferson to you, whereas the fact that there are a limited number of women who've achieved that or who he believes are kind of worthy of that, but frankly not a whole lot.
So we've spent a lot of time talking about Jefferson's tombstone the last couple days, and my question is, if you were going to go around the obelisk, would you leave the same three things he put on it, or as someone who's studying him extensively, would you alter them, add something, change it at all? And then secondly, you've spent a lot of time at Monticello. Is there anything you would change about the way they tell Jefferson's story at Monticello?
Interesting questions, Brian. I think the tombstone's pretty perfect, actually. I think the tombstone, I think he got that right. I think it's a mic drop. You know, I think he got the key principles of his life enshrined in that very few lines in those three achievements. I think if he overdid it, be like, you guys all are teachers. You know the person in the yearbook who puts everything they ever did? You know, you know, it gets lost, right? I think those three things, I don't think I'd add anything to the tombstone. As far as Monticello, you know, Monticello is a public history site. You know, one of the things we talked about earlier in the week is historians often reflect the concerns of their own time when they write. Not that we're writing about the present, but clearly the events of the present affect the questions we ask of the past and how we might approach those. Public history institutions do the same thing. So I think Monticello has really done a great job, in particularly in the recent past, and by recent past I'm talking the last 2 years, in its treatment of slavery and enslaved people, the Sally Hemings story and the Sally Hemings part of Thomas Jefferson's life, but also just dealing with what that means, as well as dealing with slavery more generally. So I think they've done a really good job with that. I think there's a really interesting space there that, or it can provide a really interesting space for us to have conversations that are hard to have. So I'll give you an example of this from my time there. And we may or may not edit this out depending on how this anecdote goes. Early on in my stay there in September, October, I met a couple. They had an evening event there with the archaeologists showing what was going on in archaeology at Monticello. And there was a little reception after that. And never one to miss a reception, I went along to that. And I was chatting with this couple who'd spent the entire day at Monticello. They went on the house tour, they went on the plantation tour, they went on the garden tour. These were ideal visitors. And then they signed up for this archaeology thing at night, and I was chatting with them. It was a full day. They were from rural North Carolina. They were from the North Carolina hills. And I, not to put too fine a point on it, I think we disagreed on politics. But we had a very interesting discussion, a very polite discussion, a very interesting discussion about Jefferson, about Monticello. It bled into contemporary issues, because inevitably when you talk about Jefferson, you end up asking, what would Jefferson think about this, that, or the other thing, right? And we had that discussion. We had a very interesting, you know, the guy asked me about how I could live. Well, he couldn't figure out how I could live here. And he did say, you speak English really well. And I said, well, I'm American. He couldn't kind of compute that I was American and lived abroad. But very, very nice couple. I want to stress this. But we had a very interesting disco. But once I explained that I was American but live here, that is in Scotland, he asked me about socialized medicine. He said, I don't know how you can live without socialized medicine. And I said, well, that's not so bad. And then we talked about the Second Amendment, and he was a very strong supporter of the Second Amendment and interpreted it in a particular way. And I said to him at one point, you got to understand, people in Scotland or people in Britain feel as strongly about the National Health Service and as strongly about their right to health care as you feel about your right to bear arms. So it's exactly, you know. And he said, I never thought of it that way. Now, he may never think of it that way again. I'm not sort of saying, oh, gee, I'm so wise. But what my point being, we had this discussion in that space because that's what public history should do. Mm. And it was a very, as I said, very civil discussion, very interesting discussion. And I came away thinking, well, you know, I'm an academic who lives abroad. I don't often talk to people I don't agree with. Mm. And and that's true on both sides of the aisle. And I think Monticello can provide that space, and I think that's a really important space, and dare I say, a very Jeffersonian space. Hmm. So,
and public history sites like Monticello are interesting because people come to them for all kinds of reasons, right? Some people come there with their family because it's a tourist thing to do while they're in that part of Virginia. Some people come because they're deeply interested in Jefferson. Some people came because they came as a child and they want to sort of re-experience that. And some people come with a lot of knowledge. Some people come, you know, knowing very little. And so that's, you know, in terms of how do you present things at those sites to meet those diverse audiences when you have such complicated questions about, you know, what Jefferson means, what slavery means as an institution, what the experience of the enslaved were. Those are very difficult challenges for the people who are working at these kinds of sites, but how to articulate some very difficult stories to such a diverse audience.
Right, and it's, if you will, neutral ground that belongs to all Americans.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's the right, and we're back to, okay, it's that creedal statement, right? He wrote it.
Hmm.
As Lin-Manuel Miranda says in the song. Enterprising man quote of mine. Anyway, and so it's the right place to it's the right space to have that conversation. There are challenges.
Mm-hmm.
One of the challenges is getting the descendants of enslaved people to go see that
mm-hmm.
space as their own. Because understandably, a plantation and a former plantation resonates in a very different way to people descended from that population than others.
Yeah, to be sure.
So there, but those are the conversations we've been having all week as well. I mean, these are the hard conversations we have to have as a culture.
And Monticello, in that respect, I think, is doing better than the vast majority of former slave plantations or slave labor camps or whatever terminology you think is appropriate. You know, some of them, when you go there, you wouldn't know that there were enslaved people living there, that they were the majority of the inhabitants, because they highlight the experience of the white family who lives there and the nice dining room table set they've got. Monticello, I think, especially in the past decade, has done some really remarkable work in terms of Jefferson's at the center, but the experience of the enslaved people are also in the center, and you can have different kinds of narratives competing.
So my question is about Jefferson being an anti-federalist, and he's written a lot of things that kind of tell us that he believes in the dangers of a large government and a large, powerful executive. But when he becomes president, he does quite a few things that some people would argue kind of expand the powers of the executive or overstep the bounds that maybe he should have had. Like, for example, when he, you know, sends the ships to Tripoli without congressional approval at first and those types of things, and there are other examples. So my question is kind of two parts. One, do you think that those really overstepped Jefferson's views of what the executive and what the government should be? And two, if so, how did he kind of reconcile those two things?
Great question, Tricia. I mean, I think, as I tried to suggest yesterday, I think he's consistent in his ends, which is advancing republicanism both at home and abroad. And I think once you, at least in my view, once you accept that the ends are consistent, the means do change. So when the Federalists are in power and he feels they're undermining republicanism, particularly at home, he's opposed to that, the use of power. And so the Jefferson that you all probably have to teach, and, you know, the textbook version of Jefferson is, of course, oh, he's a strict constructionist when it comes to the Constitution and the creation of a bank and all that stuff. And he is in the early 1790s, but we flash forward a decade and suddenly he seems to have totally changed. I don't think he's totally changed, because I think the end is the same. I think the means are different. Part of it is, and we talked a little bit about this, everybody's a critic before they're president. Once they're president, they realize, wow, this job's really hard. Of course I need the power to do this, that, or the other thing. And I think that's just human nature.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, I think he does evolve. One of the problems we have both with historical figures and with contemporary politicians is we don't allow them to change their minds. You know, because if they do, we say they flip-flopped. Or U-turned.
Mm.
Well, the Jefferson of 1792 and the Jefferson of 1802, he's the same man. I think he does have the same guiding principles, but the context has changed and his own views have changed. And I think we need to allow for people to change,
mm.
sometimes for the good and sometimes for the worse. But I think that partially explains it. And some of it is simply hypocrisy and do as I say, not as I do.
Mm.
You know, welcome to the human race, right?
I mean, that's in respect, Jefferson is a lot like Lincoln, as somebody who's has some very deeply set views on certain things that remain permanent throughout his life, but lots of other things on which he changes his views as situations change, as he gets new evidence, as the world around him changes, he, you know, evolves accordingly. They're not men set in stone on a mountain.
I think my question is a little more contemporary. I'm thinking about the takeover that took place in Charlottesville on UVA's campus about 2 years ago with the Unite the Right, and some of them were Virginia students. So I think my question is more of, if Thomas Jefferson was so worried about his legacy, and he left these papers that talked about African people of African descent in this way, and some of these students who study there maybe read those papers and then feel emboldened to take those actions, even though they did it on his beloved campus and he loved rule and public safety, do you think he could have foresaw things like this happening based on his own writings, like inspiring future generations to take his writings and do these type of actions?
It's a really hard question, Ziara. Look, the passages on race and the notes on the state of Virginia are tough to read. They are the worst things Jefferson wrote in a lifetime of writing, in my view. And there's no way to explain them away and sugarcoat them. It's a statement, it's a fairly explicit statement of white supremacy. So should we be surprised that white supremacists, because Americans of all stripes and of all political persuasions invoke the Jefferson they want. That's one of the reasons Jefferson's so interesting. He's a protean character. Everybody gets the Jefferson they want. Maybe we don't all get the Jefferson we deserve. I don't know. But it shouldn't surprise us, therefore, particularly with that kind of rhetoric, that white supremacists would invoke this. Why did they choose Charlottesville? Yeah, it was about the Robert E. Lee statue, but it wasn't just about that. It was about the symbolic importance of Charlottesville because of Thomas Jefferson. Both the university, the whole thing. I mean, it was about Jefferson. There are other Robert E. Lee statues. There are other places there are controversies about those statues. They chose Charlottesville because of Jefferson. And let's not forget, a woman died there. And Jefferson's words are there, they're available, they could be used by white supremacists, of course. They're also used by people who say, well, hold on, he said other things as well. And at risk of saying there are people on both sides, I'm not, you know, especially with regard to that particular thing, there were more UVA students opposed to that protest probably than in favor of it. But they chose that deliberately, and there's no doubt that that's part of Jefferson's legacy. There's no, forgive a terrible pun, there's no whitewashing that. Sorry, that's terrible. And that rhetoric, Jefferson was worried in his lifetime, and he expressed this to John Adams, that it was the passages on slavery where he condemned slavery in the notes on the state of Virginia that would get him into trouble, not the ones where he asserted black inferiority. Context changes. So in terms of how he would have responded to that, I don't think, you know, Jefferson did not like, and I'm not being flippant here, Jefferson did not like conflict. And he didn't like violent conflict. You know, Jefferson was, so I think he would have been horrified that at the university he strove to create, and we talked about that this morning, that university was meant to be a kind of institution that would teach and perpetuate his values. And we know those were political, but you know, it wasn't meant to be a seat of conflict like that. So I guess I have a two-part answer to your two-part question. I think we shouldn't be surprised that white supremacists use that language of white supremacy from Jefferson's writings to justify their actions. And I think while I think he would be horrified that his university became a seat of that kind of violence.
So I have a couple questions regarding Jefferson. You've mentioned when we were having our lecture that he was very conscious of what he wrote to try to avoid getting into trouble with certain things. And yet, here we are all these years later, essentially calling him such a hypocrite for his writings about slavery and humankind, and then what his personal actions and beliefs were. One, why do you think he allowed those writings to come out so we have this debate at this point in time? Because certainly I feel he must have understood or known that he would have seemed hypocritical later on. But second, I wanted to ask if you think he is fairly or unfairly has this sort of vitriol directed towards him in regards to the other founding fathers. You mentioned that there's a chance he simply could not have potentially afforded to free all his slaves upon his own death, where, like, in 1776, he's proposing an end to the Atlantic slave trade, and 10 years later, George Washington is presiding over the Constitutional Convention, extends the slave trade for another 20 years, and puts in things like the Three-Fifths Compromise.
Right. I think he left things in the record because he wasn't about doctoring the record. I mean, he wanted to present the record in a certain way so that we would understand it. And again, so there's a kind of effort to teach, as it will, posterity. But he has enough of a historical mind and historical appreciation to know you've got to preserve the record. The only thing, or the most important documents he burns are the letters between him and his wife. Because those aren't suitable for us to read, or they're none of our business, I think is his view. But the other stuff is the record. He's also not necessarily, I mean, you mentioned, Matt, you know, well, if he knew that, why didn't he anticipate? He probably didn't realize that we were going to be as concerned 200 plus years on, so concerned about race and slavery as we are, because maybe he wasn't. So there's that. In terms of the second part of your question, or your second question, you know, are we giving him a harder time than others of the so-called founding fathers? Yes, but he deserves a harder time because he's the big guy in the sense that we're back to the Declaration. I'm looking at Oz with regard to her question. It's all about the Declaration, right? If you get the credit for that, you got to take the criticism that comes with the failure for that. Now, whether, you know, James Parton, I quoted you this earlier in the week, one of Jefferson's biographers in the latter 19th century said, you know, if America is right, Jefferson is right. If Jefferson is wrong, America is wrong, or some such formulation. We don't say that about Button Gwinnett. You know, Gilda Lerman, God bless him, is probably not going to have a week-long seminar on, I don't know, pick a founder we don't really know very much about, or one of the signers of the Declaration. You know, we know the kind of top 20 signers. I'm asked the last 36 or whatever. Roger Sherman, I don't know. So, you know, he's the focus of the attention. Whether that's fair or not, to some extent, doesn't matter. I think the documentary legacy and his significance is such. And I don't like the word hypocrisy or hypocrite in this context. I don't think it really helps us very much. I think we have to approach this as historians and try to provide some context and understanding, and that's why he's interesting, frankly. People often say, oh, you're the Jefferson guy. I think, well, no, I'm not here to defend Jefferson, nor am I here to attack Jefferson. He's endlessly fascinating because of this complexity, but we have to kind of work through the complexity. So I think he is held to a slightly different standard, but he can take it.
I have a little bit of pushback on what you mentioned in terms of how Jefferson feared conflict and avoided violence. But from my understanding, he was criticized by the Federalists for his support of the French Revolution and the way the people degraded their leaders because he supported, you know, by any means, if it's for your liberty, it's okay to do that. So how do you explain that?
Good question, Martina. You know, there's the Adam and Eve letter, which we quoted. And the Adam and Eve letter, you know, which he says, I would rather see the whole world desolate, and we start again with an Adam and Eve in every country. He's basically saying, wipe out humanity and start again. That would seem, that's a very good, and he's writing about, he writes that in the context of the French Revolution. And that would seem to support your question and the premise of your question, which is that perhaps he doesn't abhor conflict quite as much as I suggested. That is a good point. I do think, and I said this the other day, I think he kind of, sometimes his rhetoric gets the better of him, and he uses this sanguinary language, and I don't think he means it, but the record is the record. We talked about this on the first day, I think. One of the reasons he appears to be duplicitous sometimes is because he doesn't like to disappoint people when he's having a conversation with them. So I think personally he does not like violence. I think in the abstract, he's okay with it. So I think you're right. So it might be an answer to Ziara's point about Charlottesville. It might have depended on how close he was to the the protest. I think if he was there and he saw that happening at his university, he would be horrified. Maybe in the abstract, if he'd say, well, you know, you're going to, you know, he said about rebellions, he said, well, we got to have these from now and then. The tree of liberty has to be watered with the blood of martyrs, all this kind of stuff. There is this language. He has this verbal tic that's quite bloodthirsty, or appears to be. You know, for example, in his management of enslaved people, he never whipped slaves. He has slaves whipped, but he doesn't do it himself. Now, you all probably have views about which is worse, but he doesn't actually do it himself. He does not like violent conflict. He never fights a duel. He's not involved in so-called affairs of honor. He doesn't like conflict and violence like that.
Doesn't serve in the military.
He's not a pacifist. I made that clear to you yesterday. But personal violence is not, and conflict is not his thing. So I'd push back on your pushback slightly and say he's making a distinction between the two. But it's a good question, and a fair question.
This isn't a question particularly about Jefferson, but more for both of you. After teaching the same course a few years in a row, I think we can all learn to anticipate the quirks or misconceptions that our students are bringing with them to certain topics. Have you noticed any interesting quirks when teaching outside of the United States?
I taught both at the high school level and at the university level in the United States. And one of the tricks I always used to employ was sort of playing with students' preconceived notions about who these people were and how American history worked and the kinds of sort of tropes they get from their parents and the broader society and all these kinds of ways that I could subvert that and play with that in the classroom. One of the things I found here is I don't actually have that pedagogical tool anymore, because most of my students don't know those tropes and don't, you know, weren't reared in that particular context, you know. And so when I tell my students, you know, the slavery was the cause of the Civil War, they're like, right, slavery was the cause of the Civil War. We don't have to have that sort of like unteaching about states' rights and the tariff or other kinds of nonsense, lost cause stuff that they got from somewhere. I don't have. The difference I find in teaching here sometimes is that sometimes the students here ask questions that American students don't ask, in part because they aren't as wedded to a certain kind of narrative that they got in middle school and then in high school. You know, for instance, the fact that the Native American experience, you know, often sort of disappears after 1890 in the ways in which we teach it in American high school, and then it reappears in the 1960s. Students here ask, what's going on with Native Americans in the 1930s? We were talking about them since the beginning of the course. Why aren't they here? And that's a question that I've found a lot more frequently on this side of the Atlantic than when I taught in the States.
I think that's a really good question. And it's an interesting question to me. It's something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. One thing to bear in mind is we have a lot of American students. Mm. So in any particular class, we've got, as you heard yesterday, about a third of our students at the university are Scottish, about a third are from the rest of the UK, and about a third are from the rest of the world. In fact, it's more than that. 42% of our students come from outside of the UK. So we have a very diverse student body. Not all of them are from the US, but US students are among the largest cohorts on campus. So we actually, in any class we teach, we have American students in class.
Yeah, we sometimes get American students who come and say, we want to get the British perspective on American history, and then they end up with the two of us teaching them, and they're like...
Well, what they're looking for, they're doing their year abroad, and they want an easy class they've already taken, we see through that, we've heard that. But I think our students fit into, the students approaching American history fit into three broad categories, and this has been pretty constant throughout. I think there are the ones who hate America and want us to tell them why it's bad. There are the ones who love America and want us to tell them why it's great. And there are the ones, this is particularly for non-US students, who recognize that there's this huge, confusing, mystifying, important country that has a lot of impact on whatever part of the world they happen to come from, and want to understand it, and are both fascinated and repelled at the same time, but genuinely curious. Unsurprisingly, they're the ones that are the most fun to teach. The first two categories, you know, you can predict the questions, you know what you're gonna get. And they vary in size depending on who's president and what's going on in the world at any given time. I mean, I've been abroad since 1992, so I've seen this ebb and flow. But it's that they're very interesting, but David's right. They don't bring the same preconceived notions. They just don't. They don't necessarily bring the same foreknowledge. But they also, for example, don't think the British, at least those of them who are British, are the bad guys in the American Revolution, for example. Why would they?
Yeah, so, they don't know the geography. I mean, that's. But other than that, they come in usually fairly well prepared. American history is extraordinarily popular here, and I think that's partially due to some very great teaching, but I think it's partially because the United States is such a fascinating topic for students, you know, who both people come from Scotland, people come from the rest of the UK, or people come from around the world. American history is very popular outside of the United States, including here. Our classes are always full.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long, long, long history. I mean, the history of British attitudes towards the United States and Scottish attitudes is a separate topic. It's a fascinating topic, and it combines people being both repelled and fascinated and attracted at the and often at the same time. And so they're great. They're great to teach. We have really great students, so we're really, really fortunate in that regard. But they, you know, they bring different perspectives.
And we, you mentioned American students studying abroad here. We have lots of our students who study abroad in their third year of undergraduate in the United States. And they're just super excited to go to Texas or California or, you know, Virginia to experience America. And it's really sort of great to see both their interests before they go and then their stories when they come back about the things that
happened. And how their attitudes changed.
Yeah, exactly.
Wasn't nearly as crazy as I thought it was going to be.
Not everybody was carrying a gun, right? It's like that kind of,
we've been talking a lot about slavery the last few days, and you also study the Civil War. So a big issue in the United States right now is reparations, especially, you know, that's a big debate for the Democratic candidates. And I was just curious about what your thoughts on, I mean, I know it's a very, you know, hot topic, so, like, what would maybe Thomas Jefferson, how would he see it, if you could throw it that way, or, you know...
Well, he's a man who didn't pay his debt, so...
Right now.
It's an issue in the UK as well. Obviously, Britain abolished slavery a generation before the United States did. But when they did abolish slavery, they did compensate people, but the people they compensated were not the enslaved people, it was the slave owners. And so they compensated them for their lost assets, essentially. You can go around this city and see the buildings that were built with the money that former slave owners received from the British taxpayer for their lost property in the West Indies and other places. There's actually a I think it's the UCL has a digital project that sort of charts, and you can walk around, especially in Newtown, say that building, all those buildings over there. And so, British. There is a reparations movement within the UK too, and they're having many of the same debates about how best to deal with the very long legacy of slavery, both within the UK and within its former empire.
That's a very articulate way of sidestepping the question, David. You didn't actually answer.
I was contextualizing the answer before I give you time to think about your answer.
As far as
your stage,
okay,
not
fair
mine.
Enough. What would Jefferson think? Well. He couldn't manage his finances, so he wouldn't have been able to. I think he would have been against this, probably. Although
he would have been intellectually intrigued by the idea.
It's an interesting question, and indeed, in my own response, and I am not channeling Jefferson here. I do not speak for Thomas Jefferson under any circumstances. I'm intrigued by the question, and in principle, it seems to make a lot of sense to me. I'm actually also intrigued by how it would work practically, which would also be Jefferson's challenge, and undoubtedly he'd work out some sort of mathematical formula that would take pages and pages and pages to do it. But so I think there's a strong moral case in favor of reparations. I qualify it in two ways. One is, okay, practically, how would this look and how would it work? You only have to look, I cite them as an example because we saw a photograph of the Hemings-Jefferson descendants the other day. Who's eligible for what? I mean, that's a bona fide question. The other problem, the other concern I have is more immediate, which is if we in the United States or in Britain paid reparations, my slight fear is that people opposed to reparations, and certainly people opposed to, well, let's not put too fine a spin on it. We have a problem with white supremacy now across the West, but including in the United States, as we saw in Charlottesville, would say, well, that's that now. problem solved. We don't want to hear another thing. And I'm not sure all our social problems where race are concerned will be solved, even with a massive reparations bill. But I could imagine the people opposed to that might even be more difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying that that's, there's a bit of that feels like, well, giving in to bullies, like we mustn't upset them. I think we're past that point. But I don't know. I think it might complicate that aspect of it in ways that we, frankly, can't foresee. That's not necessarily to be opposed, though.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine many of you have read this article, but if you haven't, one of the people who testified in Congress a couple of days ago is Ta-Nehisi Coates. And he wrote an article in 2014 in the Atlantic called The Case for Reparations.
Very persuasive.
And one of the arguments he makes there is, to be sure, he says there's an argument for reparations from slavery, but slavery ended 150 years ago. There's also a case for reparations for white supremacy that has existed in the 150 years since then. And there are people alive today who have been harmed by government policy, by government inaction, by housing policy, by all kinds of machinations originating both in Washington and at the local level, who are owed something by the American people and by the American government, above and beyond the kind of reparations for slavery. And I think that's a very powerful argument for why the continuing, the long legacy of slavery, which, you know, slavery ends in 1865, but its legacy continues in a thousand ways in the century and a half since then, in which, you know, there's a real case for, you know, restorative justice, and figuring out what form that restorative justice is going to take is an interesting question, but I think, you know, the case is a persuasive one.
In dealing with the Barbary pirates, does Jefferson get into Islam and his views of that at all?
Yes, and this is an interesting case because this is one where this has been invoked on both sides of our contemporary political discourse, particularly not immediately, but in the past decade or so. When Jefferson and Adams try to negotiate with the Moroccan minister in London in 1786, which is actually quite comical. There's the whole scene is quite interesting. And Adams ends up smoking a hookah with him and all this kind of stuff. So John Adams, party animal. And it's all about paying tribute and everything else. And so the Moroccan ambassador in London is demanding that the United States pays tribute. They're debating whether to do it or not, et cetera, et cetera. And in that exchange, either Adams or Jefferson asks him, why are you doing this to us? And the Moroccan ambassador says, well, our faith commands it, our God commands it. And this has been invoked by people to justify an assertion that basically the United States has been in conflict with Islam since the beginning. On the other hand, also in 1786, William Barclay, at the behest of Thomas Jefferson, negotiates a treaty with Morocco, or subsequently does, and in that treaty and in those negotiations, that treaty specifically stipulates that there is no religious conflict between the United States and Morocco, and no religious conflict between the United States and Islam. So there's evidence on both sides for this. I think Jefferson, because remember we talked a lot about Jefferson and religion earlier in the week, Jefferson does not want, he wants separation of church and state. For all the complexity of Jefferson in other areas, he's unequivocal on that question. So I think he recognized that some societies have state churches and things like that, but he doesn't want that for the United States, and he wants that kept out of, I believe, and having read all that stuff, foreign policy. The Barbary War for him is not a war of clash of civilizations. It's about trade and free trade, and all his rhetoric with respect to that conflict is about trade. The two belligerents are predominantly of two different faith traditions, there's no doubt about that. And the resonance of white Christian Americans being enslaved or held captives by non-white Muslims is incredibly powerful rhetorically and in a lot of the kind of popular expressions about the war and some of the propaganda around the war. But Jefferson doesn't partake in that. He just doesn't. For him, it's about trade.
Hello. So I have a two-part question.
Okay.
And both parts, I don't want them answered together.
Okay. All right, I'm writing it down.
I say that because it's going to sound like they're connected, but I want like two separate
Okay.
So first, one of the constant themes or talking points of the week was the contradictions of Jefferson. So what, in your opinion, is the biggest or most influential of those contradictions? That's the first question. It was a pretty simple one.
Oh, you're setting me up then.
And the second question, which I would like to preface that with the knowledge of Jefferson's disdain for his grandchildren with Sally Hemings.
Children.
Yeah. With Sally Hemings. But if you could take that aspect out of your response, it would be greatly helpful to me. So, all right. So, with his sexual relations with Sally Hemings, which is one of those contradictions I wanted to separate because that's not what I'm going on with the second question. What do you think he would feel about the treatment of those descendants going back to, you know, the grandchildren not being allowed to be buried in the same gravesite and, you know, that whole aspect? How do you think he would feel about that? Once again, taking out the fact that the disdain for the grandchildren. But how do you think he would feel about that, those interactions today?
Okay, so let me clarify the second question. So you want to know how he would feel about his descendants from Sally Hemings.
And the response to them from the white descendants.
Okay, all right. Thank you for that. And I will answer separately, or I'll attempt to do so. I mean, you were very specific. It was a... Yeah,
it's like an exam.
Well, it is. It feels a little bit like suddenly I'm in my PhD defense. In terms of the biggest contradiction, and I would say, Sheldon, they're slightly related because I do think the biggest contradiction, the obvious contradiction, and I'm sorry to repeat myself, has to be the contrast between the Declaration's assertion of universal equality, at least universal equality for men, and the role of slavery in his life, however we want to define that, and or both slavery as a practice and slavery as a problem. So I think that's the big, but you asked the more specific question, which I'll address. So, and I've kind of already spoken about the first one. In terms of the treatment of the descendants by other descendants, yeah. I would make clear, and I would just qualify that slightly and say, we have to bear in mind, these are two very large groups. And so there's a diversity of opinion. So among the recognized descendants of Jefferson, who are entitled to burial at Monticello, there are some people who are opposed to the Hemings descendants being included in basically in their family lines. And there are others who are totally in favor of it and are totally okay with it. Again, as far as what Jefferson would think, I mean, these what would Jefferson think questions are always hard. Again, I'm back to he doesn't like personal conflict. So let's assume, and you may not accept this assumption, but let's assume that he's okay with the racial diversity of this particular population of descendants of his on both sides. That's a huge assumption. But that being the case, I think he'd want them all to get along. and I don't think he would, I think he would be disturbed by that. Unless, if you don't accept that, and if we want to go to the Jefferson of the Notes of the State of Virginia, who's a white supremacist and doesn't want racial mixing, I'll have you know, it's important to note, and context is important, chronology is important, this is history after all. He wrote those passages in the notes before he started having children with Sally Hemings, so maybe his views might have been different. But if we accept the Jefferson of the notes, I think he'd be in favor of the white descendants saying, no, you're not really, you know, but I can't, in all honesty, so that's my answer to you. It's not really an answer because I can't really speak for Jefferson. Is that okay? Is that, I answer both. My pleasure.
Yeah, I know we've asked you a lot today to put yourself into Jefferson's shoes and to speak for him, but assuming that all men are created equal.
And women. And women, but.
Well, that goes to the point of my question.
Okay, all right, sorry, JJ.
Those are his words, all men.
Yeah, okay.
And after having daughters myself, I know that changed my view, not to say that I was a sexist, to get that clear. But
well, Rhonda's sitting right there. We can ask her.
I wonder what his views were on that with two daughters. Did he want them educated? Did he want them to strive? Did he want them to, you know, were they, and especially as as the rules maybe don't apply to me, do they not apply to my daughters too? Can my daughters be anything they want with Jefferson, or should they just simply follow into the marry well, have kids, be subservient, go on with life?
Thanks, KJ. I think both things are true, which isn't a very satisfying answer, in the sense that he does want his daughters educated. We're talking about his daughters by Martha, who survived to adulthood. And so when they go to France, you know, he puts Patsy in a convent school. In fact, he's worried she's going to become Catholic, but he puts her in there because it's the best school available. He wants his daughters educated. He treats his... We talked about some of the letters he writes when they're children, which kind of make us cringe about not reading. You know, I won't love you if you don't read Livy. But let's unpack that. He wants them to read Livy. And why does he want them to read Livy? And so, and as they mature, especially Patsy, he has a very kind of equal intellectual relationship with them. I think he's got more respect for Patsy's intellect than his son-in-law, who Patsy married, Thomas Mann Randolph, for example. So I think he does want that. Having said that, and this was with reference to the question I answered before, there are limits to this, because basically they are meant to marry well and raise Republican children themselves. He's not thinking that Patsy should be governor of Virginia. Yeah, that's not within his thinking. So he's not asserting. I mean, we can.
Nor is it within anyone else's thinking at the time.
No, right? That's right. So I think that would be too far for him. But I think where his white daughters are concerned, he does want them to be educated. He recognizes the importance at some level of educating girls and women.
Am I correct in remembering? It's been a while since I've read Annette Gordon Reed. But doesn't his relationship with Sally Hemings begin when Sally Hemings escorts one of his daughters to France so she can go to school?
Yes.
And then they show up together, and then the daughter goes off to school, and Jefferson and Sally are...
That's right.
You know, the same. But yeah, okay, good.
That's right.
So these are all these stories are connected.
Anybody else? Whoop, Wanda.
So I've sat here and struggled all week as we talk about his conflictions, right? And his writings. And I wonder, everything that he puts in writing, is it to control his own legacy, or is it an attempt for him to balance out within himself, this is ethical, but I have to do this? Because I get the feeling that he wants us to look back upon him and go, well, he knew the right thing to do, but he just couldn't do it.
He's acutely aware of his legacy. And this is a generation, he comes from a generation that has a very deep kind of understanding of history and historical awareness. And he's recognizing, why does he preserve his papers? He's trying to shape his legacy. I don't think he thinks he's necessarily as inconsistent as we think he is. So I don't think he's right. So I'd slightly push back a little bit, Rhonda, on that. I don't think he's saying, oh, look, they'll see I'm struggling with this so much as he thinks he's right. I mean, this guy is not lacking in self-confidence, even though he doesn't like public speaking. But, you know, I think he thinks, yeah, you know, if I leave this documentary record, people will work out that I was right. Brackets. Hamilton was wrong. So I think he thinks he's consistent. And in this, I'm not holding him up for criticism. I'd say that's true of all of us. We probably don't all think the same things today that we thought 20 years ago, but we don't think, oh, I'm a hypocrite now. We think, oh, well, either I've evolved or, no, I've been entirely consistent throughout. I mean, not all of us, but most of us probably think we're right most of the time. Unless we've committed a real faux pas, we're demonstrably wrong. So I don't think he necessarily thinks he's inconsistent. I think he thinks we'll see, in preserving his legacy, we'll see that he was right. And again, I don't think it's simply vanity. I want to stress that. I think he believed that his vision of the future of the United States and his vision of republicanism was crucial to the success of the United States and the spread of liberty and so on and so forth. So it's not just, hey, look at me, look what I did. It's, you got to get what I was about, because if you don't, we're going to get all this wrong. And God help us, we'll be like Britain. Listeners won't be able to see that way. The gesture our assistant just made, who's British. Welsh. Anyone else? While we're on record, since we're actually on record,
yes.
Can I take a moment to acknowledge and can you acknowledge the huge efforts and successful efforts that our assistants Kristen and John made this week?
On that note, I think I speak for myself certainly, as well as Kristen, who is guarding our food, but especially for everybody here, for what an extraordinary teacher Frank has been to us all this week. With that in mind, we've all signed a card for you, Frank. So.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Thank you. You've been great. It's down to Jefferson. It's down to the material, plus you guys. All I'm doing is standing here and trying not to mess up the PowerPoints. Thank you.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.